Hey, before we get to the show, I wanted to remind you to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders. If you haven't signed up yet, sign up now to get ad-free episodes, twice monthly bonus episodes, and a whole bunch of other cool stuff at patreon.com/curbsiders. Paul, I have one that's slightly on topic.
Great.
You guys got puns for this? Because I was like, I don't know how they're going to find them.
Oh, I just do a pun that makes no sense for every episode.
Oh, okay. Good.
Paul, what does a vegetarian zombie eat?
Ooh. Vegetables, I assume?
Grains.
All right.
It's almost Halloween, Paul. Come on.
Yeah, and I just for our audio listeners, Watto did an arms out sort of rocking back and forth zombie thing with while saying that. So just if you can imagine that, that was the best part of it.
The Curbsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity aside from possibly Cash Like More Hospital and affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we aren't responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're wrong.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders. I'm Dr. Matthew Frank Watto. Not proud of my pun. Here with my great friend and America's primary care physician, at least that's what his mom writes in his underwear, Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Hi, Paul.
You know, my mom really thinks the world of you, by the way. I don't know that she knows that you say that, but she really, she asks about you. She pronounces your name Watto, but it's very cute.
Wasn't that a thing you would make fun of kids in the 80s? You'd be like, yeah, your mom stencils your underwear, like put your name in your underwear or something like that, right?
I only know that as a reference from the movie Real Genius.
Maybe. And it was around, Paul. It was a diss.
Sure.
It was a sick burn.
I'm sure it wasn't high praise.
From back in the day. All right. Well, today on the show, we're going to discuss eating disorders. It's been a really long time since we've done that. And particularly discussing eating disorders in the GLP-1 era, which has made a whole new can of worms. There's also a lot of new terminology. You'll hear about it. But our guest is the great Dr. Laura M. Bridge. And before we tell you all about her and introduce our wonderful co-host, Paul, what is it that we do on Curbsiders?
Sure. Matt, as a reminder to our listeners, we are the internal medicine podcast. We use expert interviews to bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge. As you mentioned, we are joined by another host, the excellent and familiar to our listeners, PA Isabel Valdez. Isabel, how are you?
I'm doing great. It's been a good conversation tonight, guys.
It was far-ranging. Yeah, so tell us through it.
Yeah, sure. Well, tonight we were with Dr. Laura Bridge, who taught us how to keep health as the main goal for our patients as we connect them with an important team members like psychotherapists and dietitians. She is an internal medicine physician who specializes in both general primary care and the outpatient medical treatment of individuals with eating disorders. She graduated from Georgetown University School of Medicine after completing a dual military and civilian internal medicine residency at Wright-Patterson Air Force and Wright State University. She spent 8 years in the active duty Air Force. So thank you for your service. She served as a clinical faculty member at the U.S. Air Force School of Aerospace Medicine and as an adjunct assistant professor of medicine at the F. Edward Herbert School of Medicine of the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences. She is currently an assistant professor of clinical medicine at The Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio, where her practice focuses on the medical care of individuals with eating disorders. She is an active member of the Academy for Eating Disorders and a past presenter at the International Conference of Eating Disorders.
A reminder that this and most episodes will be available for CME credit for all health professionals through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. Laura, thank you for joining us. And the audience has heard your bio, but they want to know a hobby or interest that you enjoy outside of medicine.
So I really enjoy writing. If I had a profession that was not medicine, I probably would have been a writer. And I've gotten back into it more recently. So I've been taking some writing courses just for fun in my downtime. And I like reading. So I would say writing and reading.
Any recent book that you would recommend to the audience? Just a quick recommendation?
Oh, no, this wasn't on the list of pre-questions.
Okay, I guess you used to like reading. You haven't read anything recently.
No, I actually have read too many books. So I don't
like
think
what's
I
on your nightstand right now. That's what, you know, how about that one?
No, I do a lot of audiobooks.
Okay.
So,
oh, I love audiobooks. All right, what do you got?
I just listened to one called Shield of Sparrows, which is like kind of a sort of romanticy. It's very long, but it's good. And then it ends on this terrible cliffhanger, and you have to wait until like 2026 to find out what happens next, because I guess that's when the next book is going to be released.
Let's hope George R.R. Martin isn't writing that.
It was recommended to me by the girl at the local bookstore, so I tried it out, and it ended up being really great.
All right, thank you.
Now I'm like on the edge of my seat for another year and a half.
Paul, are you into romanticies? I feel like that's your genre.
I've not had enough exposure to know for sure. I might be. I don't. Maybe this is the time to dip my toe in.
I think you could use some.
Sure. I was just thinking, it's funny that we've worked together long enough, Matt, that I knew to give you space to make the George R.R. Martin joke. And if you didn't, then I was going to hop in and grab it. So I did want to ask you, Laura, in terms of your own writing, is there a genre, like, are you doing fiction, novel? Like, what are you writing, and what is your focus been?
Yeah, so fiction, and then like short, like reflective essays. So I've written a couple of short, I haven't published anything yet, but a couple like short reflective essays that are sort of about things that have happened in like medical school and sort of those things, but then also like fiction. I really like sort of the mystery thriller genre. So, but coming up with a good cohesive plot is hard. So I haven't actually written a full story from start to finish yet. I just keep writing pieces of things.
My favorite authors like don't know where they're going when they go, though. I don't know that there's a necessarily like the mystery genre writers, but I think like Stephen King, I think even Neil Gaiman, who's since sort of fallen out of favor, but I think both of them sort of don't quite know where they're going to end up when they get started, which I also find kind of fascinating.
I was going to say Substack is out there. You know, that's a good place to just write, you know, hang a shingle and just start writing. Like, you know, it's longer than Twitter. You can kind of write posts as long as you want.
Isn't that how Twilight got started, with like Twitter and like a couple of tweets, and then it became a story? I don't know. I've been told.
You've been told.
Also, I've been told.
All right. Now that we're speculating how Twilight got started, I think that means it's time to go to Cashlack for a case. So, Isabel, let's hear our first case.
Sounds good. Well, welcome to everybody. We're just going to start with Marion. Marion is a 49-year-old female with a history of anxiety. She's transferring care to you from a self-pay practice and requests refills for semaglutide that a non-specialist was prescribing for her weight control and glucose tolerance. Her only other medication is weekly alendronate for osteoporosis since last year. And her vitals in clinic today, which are relevant, are blood pressure of 96/67, heart rate 87. She is 5'4", weighs 93 pounds, and has a BMI of 16. How I got this story was, this case was from a listener who shared that this was an interest for her. She shared it to us with here at Curbsiders. So I need to understand patients like Marianne so I can spot them, and that's why you're here to help us. So what kind of red flags do you see in this patient's history that would prompt you to consider that this patient may be experiencing an eating disorder?
Lots of red flags. So I mean, I guess the couple glaring ones, she's taking a GLP-1 receptor agonist without an FDA approved indication, right? So she glucose intolerance is not an FDA-approved indication. They're approved for diabetes mellitus type 2, but not glucose intolerance. And then, you know, she is underweight, so she doesn't meet weight criteria. She's hypotensive. She's underweight, right? And then she's pretty young to have osteoporosis, to the severity of, like, needing to be on a bisphosphonate. So all of those things are red flags.
Right. At this point, like now that we know the red flags and when we know where this conversation is going towards, like, what eating disorders are you suspicious of? So I guess if you're starting to brainstorm what this could be, what kind of questions would you start to ask this patient so that we could arrive at a diagnosis of, well, Am I giving it away? Is it anorexia? And how do we arrive to that?
Yeah. So the first important point is to make sure, like, I always make sure I have like the patient's permission to enter into the conversation with them. And then the second, I think, key point is not to judge by appearances. So this could be any of the eating disorders. So bulimia, binge eating disorder. I mean, she could be using a variety of behaviors. You don't know anything about her yet. Just you have some red flags, but you don't really know like what her history has been, what came before this. She has some red flags to restriction, but she could be using other behaviors as well. So the two restrictive eating disorders, I mean, very high risk of the two restrictive eating disorders, which should be anorexia and ARFID. The most common eating disorder is actually other specified feeding and eating disorder. So it's kind of a catch-all for eating disorders that don't neatly fall into one of the diagnostic categories that are outlined by the DSM-5. So right now you just know, like, we have some concerns. To get more information, I would just start asking questions like, why are you taking this medication? You know, like, what are you worried about? What are you, like, why was it started and what are your goals? And like, why did you continue to take it?
Laura, well, I guess two questions. Can you just tell people what ARFID is? Because that's one that I wasn't exactly familiar with before this. And then I want to go back to ask how do you ask for permission? I know for you, it's probably easy, but I think that that's not like, that's a hard step and I don't want to skip over that. So ARFID, and then we can talk about how we ask permission.
ARFID is avoidant restrictive feeding and eating disorder. It was new to the DSM when the DSM-5 came out. But I think the pattern has been recognized longer than that. So the complications of anorexia and ARFID are the same in that they are both restrictive eating disorders. So you're looking at problems of malnourishment, but the underlying cause of the restriction is different. So anorexia tends to be more motivated by like weight concerns and body dissatisfaction, and ARFID is more often a sensory issue. Sometimes you can see ARFID after an episode of like choking. So there's like a fear of eating for some other reason.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think I've seen that before. It was an adult with autism, and this person just decided they didn't want to eat for whatever reason, and they actually presented with like scurvy. It was a wild case. Because we couldn't get the person to eat. So it was a very challenging situation. I did not know that that's what it was called. I don't think people were writing ARFID in the chart at the time. And then you mentioned the other, that the third diagnosis. Can you tell OSFED? A little bit about that? Yes.
So OSFED is other specified feeding and eating disorder. So there's other specified feeding and eating disorder, and there's unspecified eating disorder, feeding and eating disorder, or unspecified eating disorder. Unspecified eating disorder is used when you're still kind of like working up the problem and you don't, you haven't landed on a diagnosis yet. You know that there's an eating disorder, but you haven't kind of pinned down like which diagnosis you're going to land on. And then other specified feeding and eating disorder is more when it doesn't quite meet the criteria of the other defined eating disorders. So anorexia, bulimia, binge eating disorder, ARFID.
Okay. Paul, does that satisfy? You think are we missing anything here? We're pushing through?
Yeah, you'd have to ask the expert. No, I think we're doing great so far, but I guess in this particular setting, sort of as you sort of make your way in, so yeah, sort of about the permission and then sort of what
permission.
Yeah. So that was the other part I was actually especially curious. And so how do we get to the point where we can start asking questions, narrow these things down?
So the way that our clinic is set up is like, you know, we have like our workstations. And so I'm usually like sitting at a computer and the patient's usually on the other side of the room for me. So it's not often like a very patient-centric setup, right? So I usually make sure that I am making eye contact. I always have a box of tissues. Because sometimes it can be like a very, it can be an emotional conversation sometimes. And then often the patient will bring it up. So like if the patient comes in and I try to lead off of however the patient, I try to use the patient's language back with them and reflect the patient's language back. And then whatever opening the patient gives me, I try to use that as a lead-in. So if the patient comes in and they're like, will you refill my semaglutide or my, you know, liraglutide or whatever it is that they're taking, I say, oh, can you tell me more about, like, how long have you been on this medication? Or, you know, like, why did you start it? What is it doing for you? You know, like, and then I'll ask, is it okay if we talk a little bit more about this? Is it okay if we talk a little bit more about your history with eating? Is it okay if we talk a little bit more about your history with weight or dieting? And then I'll say, you know, like, if I'm meeting a new, I have a consultation clinic where I'm just seeing patients for eating disorder consultation. So for my eating disorder consultation clinic, like, they're coming in for eating disorder consultation. But I'll say, you know, this is a difficult conversation to have. Feel free to tell me if I'm saying something that upsets you. Feel free to tell me that you need to take a break. And, you know, like, we're doing this together. So you get to choose how to tell me and what you want to tell me. And I'll say, just, like, take me back to the beginning and tell me how this started. And what is it that you want to, what is your goal? Like, what is it that you want to accomplish?
I think that's a great approach for this and for the rest of the cases we're going to see, but also just in general. I love how you do that. So thanks for sharing that, for sure.
This episode is brought to you by locumstory.com. Full disclosure, what I'm about to say is a sponsored promotion from locumstory.com. But the weird thing here is there's nothing they're trying to sell you. Locumstory.com is simply a free, unbiased educational resource about locum tenens. It's not an agency. They simply exist to answer your questions about the how-tos of locums on their website, podcast, webinars, videos, and they even have a locums 101 crash course. Locumstory.com is where you should go to find out if locum tenens make sense for you and your career goals. What makes locumstory.com unique is that it's more of a peer-to-peer platform with real physicians sharing their experiences and stories, both the good and bad, about working locum tenens. Hence the name, Locum Story. Locumstory.com is a self-service tool, which means you can poke through their content at your own pace with no pressure or obligation. So that's it for this sponsored promotion, which was sponsored by a completely free-to-use sponsor, locumstory.com. This episode is brought to you by Panacea Legal. This Thanksgiving, there's a lot to be thankful for, but Panacea Legal wants to add one more thing to your gratitude list. An employment contract you feel confident in. Panacea Legal supports physicians through one of the most important career decisions, signing or renegotiating a contract. Because while you care for patients, Panacea Legal can focus on protecting your career. Panacea Legal can catch the details others miss. Restrictive non-competes, unfair compensation structures, call expectations that can take over your life, the things that look harmless until they're not. So, before you carve the turkey, carve out time for your future. Get peace of mind knowing you're making the right move for your next job and your future. Panacea Legal is giving Curbsiders listeners one more reason to feel thankful with 50% off any contract review service by using promo code CURB50. But hurry, this offer is only available for the first 10 doctors who use the code. Visit panacea.legal today. That's panacea.legal. Attorney advertising. Prior results don't guarantee similar outcomes. Information provided is not legal advice and does not create an attorney-client relationship.
So far, we have some red flags with this patient, right? She's on a medication, but we don't have an FDA-approved indication.
Indication, yeah.
Having trouble speaking today. She has a low BMI, she has low blood pressure, and she's 49 and has osteoporosis, which is a young age to have that without, like, a clear, we don't have a full medical history yet, but that's a little suspicious at that age. And we said that we're going to, you know, our differential right now is could be anorexia, could be ARFID, which is avoidant restrictive feeding and eating disorder, could be
food intake disorder.
Other specified. I'm sorry?
Avoidant restrictive food intake disorder.
Food intake disorder. Okay. Other specified feeding and eating disorder, OSFED, right? That's the one that's kind of, if it doesn't fit into any of the other eating disorders, that's what you would land on. But while you're working up, you just call it unspecified.
That's, so OSFED and unspecified are different.
Right.
OSFED there can be like overlap. So you could have features of like bulimia, you can have features of anorexia overlapping with each other. Mm-hmm. And so that would be like an OSFED picture. And then unspecified is the one that you use when you're working it up.
Yeah. When you're working it up, right. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then a good opening might, you know, if the patient gives you an opening, they're here to refill the medication, you could say something like, oh, I was curious about why you're on that. I saw you were on that. I was curious about why you might be taking that. Is it okay if we talk about that more? And you kind of ask permission. And then based on their answer, you might ask permission to go further down that list of questions that you have about this. Is that
perfect?
More or less?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. All right. So Isabel, where are we going to go next for this patient?
Well, so we're starting to get a clear sign of this. Now, I'm in primary care. This is not my forte. And I also want to be sure that I'm diagnosing correctly. Like, are there kind of any kind of tools that we could use on the day-to-day, like a diagnostic screening test or something that you can recommend that we could use in primary care just to kind of guide us as well with this diagnosis?
So there's two screenings that we use in primary care. The SCOF, which was originally developed in the UK, it tends to miss the binge eating. So like binge eating disorder and bulimia nervosa, it tends to be a little bit more sensitive for the restrictive eating disorders, but the SCOFF, S-C-O-F-F. And then the screening for eating disorders, which is 5 questions. And that tends to be more sensitive for like all of the eating disorders. I actually, so no screening questionnaire has been found to, I think, be superior to clinical judgment. So like the NICE guidelines, which are used in the UK, their bottom line of the NICE guidelines is use your best clinical judgment, right? So they can help, like if you have an idea of the questions on the questionnaires. The more robust questionnaires like the EDEQ and the EAT are more cumbersome to use. I don't even use them. They're more for like a psychiatrist or a psychologist to use. You kind of have to have experience in using those.
But at least these two are the SCOF, the eating disorder screening for primary care, the EDDS. Those are the ones we can maybe conceivably start. Is that we should keep in our arsenal? Is that what I heard?
Yeah, the screening for eating disorders.
Mm-hmm. Paul, I was tipped off that the SCOF questionnaire was not developed in the U.S. because the O stands for one stone, which I'm told is 14 pounds. Have you lost 14 pounds in 3 months?
That's very astute, Matt. Yeah.
Thank
and they
you.
Didn't spell esophagus with an O either.
So it sounds like, you know, every time we ask experts about questionnaires and scoring systems, Paul, I just find that they always have kind of internalized and they're like, yeah, those are out there, but I kind of just clinical judgment. Yeah. Yeah. Well, so we have license to use those, but if our clinical judgment is our spidey sense is kind of telling us something's going on here, then maybe we're going to refer to someone like yourself for help.
So, Laura, I would love to get a sense of how these conversations go. So, for instance, with this patient who comes in and has been on, I believe it's semaglutide, who has a BMI of 16, and you ask, so what are you taking this medication for? And if she responds, I like that it helps me lose weight, or I like that it helps me maintain the weight that I'm at, then where does that conversation go for you as the patient sort of shares their goals? What is your goal for this patient and sort of where are you trying to steer things from here? Like for us, I guess it's a different discussion as to sort of how do you have a conversation about making the referral. But for you who's seeing this person, where does the conversation take you typically and what does it look like?
So usually two different directions. One, I'll try to ascertain why is it important for them to maintain a low body weight, right? Like, what is it that why are they so concerned about their weight? The most common response that I'll get to that question is, I need to be healthy, right? And so then that launches us into a conversation about what is health. And so we have to redefine some terms, like what is health and how is health different from weight? And how sometimes losing weight makes us less healthy, as in the case of this individual, she's developed osteoporosis, right? She's underweight. She's probably malnourished. So, you know, we talk about the difference between weight and health. And then the other direction that that I'll often take the conversation in addition to like talking about the difference between weight and health, because often the most common, almost 100% of the time, it is, I need to be healthy. Sometimes patients will just flat out say it's vanity. Every once in a while, patients will admit like it's just my appearance. And I'm like, all right, well, at least you're being honest with me, right? And then the other thing is I'm really, really big on educating patients. And this doesn't just apply to my eating disorder practice. I think patients need to know why we're doing a test, why we're prescribing a medication, what is that medication doing? And so we talk about, okay, so this is what this medication is, this is how it works, this is what it's doing in your body. And these are the side effects and the risks if you decide to continue this medication.
That's great. Yeah, thank you. That is exactly what I was looking for. Thank you.
Is there anything else in the history that you're asking about, like a standard history? Are you asking everybody about binging and purging? Are you asking people about like exercise addiction? What other things should you ask about if you suspect someone has a restrictive eating disorder, or not even just restrictive, just an eating disorder? Before, let's say we're in the unspecified category right now because we don't have enough information to categorize them.
Yes. Okay. So I have a kind of standard intake that I do with all of my patients. So in our Division of Internal Medicine at Ohio State, I specialize in eating disorders, but then I have colleagues who actually specialize in weight management. We refer back and forth to each other quite a bit. And my intake actually looks a lot like their intake. So they're asking the same questions. Their priorities and their goals are different, but we're asking a lot of the same questions. So I do like a full eating, like life history. You know, tell me all your diet history. When was your first diet? How many diets have you been on? How many times have you like lost and gained weight? And sometimes people can't even quantify that because it's like too many to count, right? I'll like gain 10 pounds, lose 10 pounds, gain 15 pounds, lose 15 pounds, right? But I'll ask them like, how old do you remember when you started your first diet? I'll ask about family when they were young, like their family's relationship with food when they were growing up, because usually these are learned behaviors. There's often like a learned component to this or some kind of pressure in childhood. I'll ask about like food insecurity when they were younger or food deprivation when they were younger, restriction from food. There's often in eating disorders, there's often a history of, not always, but there is frequently like a history of trauma, comorbid anxiety and depression. So I'm always just very sensitive to that. So I'll get like a childhood history, and then I'll get like a full weight history. When was your lowest weight? What was it? What were you doing to get to that weight? What was your highest weight? You know, like what was happening then? In women, I'm like outside of pregnancy. We're talking like in adulthood. So after, usually I'll say like since high school, excluding pregnancy, what was your lowest adult weight, highest adult weight, current weight? If they're weighing themselves, because compulsive weighing is often a behavior that individuals with eating disorders will use. And then I'll go through the whole list of all of the different behaviors. So like binging, purging, laxative use, diuretic use, any kind of like anything that they've bought or subscribed to or used to try to lose weight. And people, I'm always surprised. I'm always hearing new things that people have bought off of like infomercials or Amazon or just really sometimes very harmful things. You know, we have these conversations. This is why I keep tissues, because the wellness industry is a huge money-making industry that's preying on desperate, anxious, vulnerable people. And so my patients are falling for all of these schemes, right? They're subscribing to these like, one of my patients was taking these pills that were basically like chalk tablets that were supposed to absorb the extra calories. You know, they subscribe to these very expensive shake plans and all kinds of stuff. And then I'll ask them if they've ever taken any weight loss, anything, prescribed or not prescribed. And it could be like a tea, a cleanse, a supplement. These are all kind of like indicators that there's something unhealthy going on, some kind of disordered relationship with their body, with food, with eating. So we go through all of that. And then I have like a review of systems. I think that's a question in a later case, like, you know, what kind of symptoms might a person present with? But I go through kind of like a review of systems. that's kind of specific to eating disorders. I ask about like injuries, you know, like stress fractures and things like that. Mm-hmm. I get a menstrual history in my female patients. So those are kind of like, it takes a long time. So for my new consults, I have 60-minute appointments.
Yeah. And they're filling out this questionnaire ahead of time, right? So that you can...
We do it together.
Oh, you do it together. Oh, yeah. That would take a long time. Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay.
And can I ask sort of one more vague question that may not be a great answer to, and then I promise I'll stop taking up quite so much time. So I imagine in your consultative clinic, the patients are either aware of or considering or sort of at least ready to have a conversation about the diagnosis of one of the eating disorders. And I feel like my sense is in like the primary care setting or sort of non-specialty settings, there might be a resistance to even the diagnosis. Is that a misperception? Or I guess how is this sort of normally, do you have a sense of how this is sort of normally reacted to when it's sort of brought up initially as opposed to when you're seeing them in consultation? And I recognize this is a vague, and again, question that's going to vary from person to person.
Yeah, I usually get two responses. And again, it kind of depends on how the patient is presenting. So like in case one, where the patient is underweight and they're taking a weight loss medication and they're seeking you to like refill the weight loss medication that they're taking, I would kind of anticipate that that would be met with resistance, right? Like, I don't have a problem. This is not a problem. One of the features of eating disorders like anorexia, Matt and I were kind of talking about this before we started recording, but one of the features of eating disorders like anorexia is ambivalence and sort of like a denial that there's a problem going on. And so, yeah, that can be a dicey conversation. You have to tread carefully. But often, especially in individuals who are larger bodied, who have been pressured by themselves, by family, by healthcare providers, by friends, to lose weight and have tried and tried and tried everything and not been successful at losing weight and keeping it off. When you have that conversation about, well, maybe it's like, let's not talk about the weight. And, you know, like maybe there's something else going on here. And let's just focus on normalizing your pattern of eating and improving your relationship with your body and food. I mean, like often that's a release for patients, like they feel relieved and validated.
So I do want to move on so we can get to the next case. So it sounds like this first case, let's say we take the history, we're pretty sure that this is a restrictive eating disorder. We think probably anorexia. And from what I've read, GLP-1 receptor agonists would be contraindicated in an active eating disorder, especially a restrictive eating disorder, right? So what would the treatment plan look like and sort of how often are you seeing people to get them through this and let's start with that.
So the treatment plan, the way I kind of present it to patients for any eating disorder is a multidisciplinary team approach. So I say you have to have a therapist who's experienced with eating disorders because psychotherapy is like fundamental to any eating disorder treatment. You have to have a dietitian because the first line therapy for any eating disorder is one, psychotherapy, two, nutritional therapy. So whether it's binge eating or bulimia or anorexia, normalizing the eating pattern and making sure that they're eating regular meals and snacks and meeting their nutritional needs is like fundamental. Mm-hmm. So they have to have a dietitian, they have to have a therapist or a counselor, both of whom are experienced with eating disorders. And then I'm just here for the medical monitoring. So if they're medically stable, electrolytes are normal, cardiovascularly, they're like stable, you know, they're not at any medical risk, I can see them less frequently. Like if they're stable for outpatient management in terms of their eating disorder, they're doing like outpatient therapy, outpatient dietitian, I can see them every couple months probably. Sometimes they'll have a standing lab order to get labs more frequently. But if they are purging, especially any kind of purging, laxative, diuretic, vomiting, that's a unstable situation because electrolytes can change very rapidly. You know, if they are cardiovascularly not stable, so if they have big heart rate variabilities when they go from laying to standing or they're bradycardic at rest, so any kind of like medical instability, I'm seeing them more frequently. And you can see that in any of the eating disorders as well. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, that's great. So therapists, everyone needs a therapist for psychotherapy, a dietitian to help work with normalizing the eating pattern. You're there to monitor the medical stuff. You're looking for orthostatic, you know, positive orthostatic vital signs, bradycardia. Those can be some of the things. And you said if people are purging, that becomes a higher risk situation. All right. Well, this is great. I'm learning a lot, and we're gonna keep talking around this. But let's go to the next case, and we can put any other questions into these next cases we're gonna get to. So, Isabel, I'll let you take us
through. Sure. Now we have Ada. She is a 52-year-old female that presents with class 2 obesity, a BMI of 36, hypertension, type 2 diabetes as well. She recently disclosed a longstanding history of bulimia nervosa. Her hemoglobin A1C was risen to 8.1 after she stopped taking metformin because of the side effects, and she's interested in using a GLP-1 receptor agonist for her weight management. So here we have a different case with the GLP maybe being reasonable, but what kind of physical exam findings would you look for in this patient who has a different disorder that we should be aware of?
Right. So in any of my eating disorder patients, I'm doing a comprehensive physical exam. But in patients who purge, they're often, you know, you talk about Russell's signs, which are the calluses on the fingers. It's very infrequent that you're going to see that. Usually patients are purging with instruments that are not their fingers. And sometimes they don't even need an instrument in order to purge. Dental erosion and dental caries or other dental issues is something that you can see. Salivary gland swelling, yes, is something that can be seen. Or like a sialadentitis. Hair thinning from malnutrition is common in all of the eating disorders. Skin thinning, different kinds of skin rashes. It's pretty uncommon to see the lanugo hair growth, which is sort of that like fine white hair, facial hair that grows when patients are really malnourished. But I'd say the most common thing that I'm always checking on all my patients, like the most common sign that I see is sort of cardiac instability. So bradycardia and then sort of like a postural tachycardia. So that's one way to distinguish between an athletic heart and a starved heart. So you'll have patients who come in and their heart rate will be like 45 and they say, oh, well, I'm a runner and just very fit. But then you lay them down and you stand them up and their heart rate goes from 45 to 110, which is very common. And so that is a sign of a starved heart. When I'm doing orthostats, I don't even have patients go from laying to sitting. I just go laying to standing. I have them stand for 3 minutes and I just check their heart rate and blood pressure every minute for 3 minutes. So I'm doing orthostats in almost all my patients and an ECG in almost all of my patients. You can sometimes hear a heart murmur in malnourished patients who have, like, you can get like mitral valve prolapse. Swelling and fluid retention are very common when there's purging going on because you get disruption of sort of the RAAS system. So you get overproduction of all of those like vasopressin and different hormones that kind of cause you to hold on to fluid. And then those upregulate, they don't downregulate quickly. So fluid shifts and like fluid retention tend to be a really big issue. And you can actually get something called pseudo-Barter syndrome if they get IV fluids. Or when they stop purging, they can just get like really intense swelling and fluid retention, which we use spironolactone to treat that sometimes just to alleviate the symptoms.
That's neat because aldosterone is turned on. Mm-hmm. I was reading about that. That's pretty cool physiology. Because I was wondering why the swelling was happening and I didn't look into it as much. So I'm glad you said it.
Aldosterone gets like, so sometimes patients will fluid restrict when they're like restricting food, mm-hmm. and aldosterone will get ramped up. But then if they're purging, so they go through like binge purge cycles, the fluid balance just gets like very disrupted. Yeah. And so if aldosterone gets upregulated, it takes a little bit of time after you sort of normalize fluid intake and food intake for aldosterone to sort of like downregulate again. So while it's still upregulated, if you're giving fluid or you're taking fluid in, then the body's just going to hold on to all that fluid, and people can really, really get some pretty intense swelling. So swelling is very common.
This episode is brought to you by Grammarly. It's kind of an amazing time to be alive because we have all of these tools at our disposal to help us get our projects looking really polished and high quality. But oftentimes these tools are fragmented. You might have one app that you are actually writing the proposal in a separate app where you're asking AI to help polish your language. And as a result, you're just doing a lot of clicking back and forth and switching between different applications and tools. But Grammarly has features that are tailor-made for working professionals so you can get all of your writing done from start to finish all in one place. Grammarly helps you bring more polish and impact to your emails, presentations, and proposals without switching between tools and tabs, all while amplifying your voice and moving your ideas forward. One tool in particular I like is they actually have this AI assistance that helps you shape the tone of your language. So for instance, if you want to write something that is more persuasive in tone, you can just feed some sentences into it and it will give you suggestions and a place to start. Grammarly is designed to keep your ideas flowing from a blank page to a final work. It is designed to help professionals with real-time writing support on any project, email, and more. And it's an easy place to get quick help from AI whenever you're writing. 90% of professionals say Grammarly has saved them time writing and editing their work. Just start a new doc from your Grammarly homepage to use the features. It is fast and easy. And when you open that new doc, start typing right away or ask Grammarly's AI chat for help anytime, whether to kick off your ideas or polish them. For example, you can ask Grammarly's AI chatbot about brainstorming a proposal, summarizing meeting notes, or crafting a specific sales strategy. Sign up for free and experience how Grammarly can elevate your professional writing from start to finish. Visit grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Hydro. And listen, audience, you know that I'm an exercise freak. I can't get enough of it. Might say something about my mental health, but let's put that aside. This holiday season, I want you to train smarter, not longer. The Hydro rowing machine delivers the best results. Hydro is your go-to for the ultimate full-body workout. How ultimate? It's 86% of your muscles that are working when you're using this. That's arms, legs, and core, and it's twice as efficient as cycling or running. Just 20 minutes is all it takes to feel the results. Whether you're training hard, staying consistent, or getting a jump on your New Year's goals, Hydro meets you where you are and pushes you further. All the workouts are led by Olympians and world-class athletes, filmed in breathtaking locations around the world with the largest library of rowing workouts. Hydro's newest rower, the Hydro Arc, delivers such powerful results that GQ magazine named it the best rower of 2025. And right now, Hydro is making it easy to give the gift of fitness with free standard shipping, a 30-day risk-free trial, and a one-year warranty. So this year, give yourself something that moves, motivates, and truly delivers: a Hydro rower. Listen, rowing is a regular part of my workouts. I love it. I actually want to get a rower for my own house. This is a great option. So head over to Hydro.com and use the code CURB to save up to $600 off on Hydro Rower during this holiday season. That's HYDROW.com, code CURB, to save up to $600. Hydro.com, code CURB. I wanted to ask America's PCP if he would feel comfortable that this person's taking a GLP-1 receptor antagonist. Paul, would this make you nervous? Would you be referring to Laura?
Yeah, or at least maybe getting a text or a phone call. Yeah, I'm not sure what I would do in the situation. I think were it me, because we haven't really gotten the details of the case, if this is something that is still very active. So there's longstanding history, but that's not the same thing as something that is sort of ongoing. But I would still be nervous just because of ignorance more than anything else. So yeah, I was actually very curious to hear how Laura, because otherwise this is a person for whom slam dunk home run GLP-1 or incretin therapy would be perfect. Like, it really sort of checks all the boxes. But how should the presence of a diagnosis of bulimia impact that, Laura?
Eating disorders flip all the time. So individuals frequently shift between eating disorder presentations. So it's common for somebody to start out with anorexia and then develop bulimia and then develop binge eating and then shift back into anorexia. So you have to be cautious that you're not making something worse with your intended treatment. One of the sort of fundamental principles about treating an eating disorder is, again, we said in the beginning, like you want to try to normalize food intake and nutrition. A brain that's not getting regular meals and is not like getting regular nutrition is going to have a difficulty with emotional regulation, autogenic regulation. And so lots of like mood swings, impulse control, all of those things are going to be more difficult. So it just makes recovery harder. So that's one of the reasons why sort of like the nutritional rehabilitation is, you know, part like fundamental to eating disorder treatment. And GLP-1 receptor agonists can sort of interfere with that nutritional rehabilitation. One of the things that individuals with eating disorders, all eating disorders, try to learn is sort of like mindfulness of their hunger and fullness cues. So it's common for individuals who have an eating disorder to not be eating, not even be aware of what hunger or fullness feel like. Whether they have anorexia or binge eating or bulimia or a little bit of all of the different categories, they may not have ever experienced hunger or fullness. So trying to help them learn what is hunger, what is fullness, what is some other emotion, you know, like, or some other sensory experience, like some other sensation, physical sensation that is not hunger and fullness, and how to distinguish between those. Then you add a GLP-1 receptor agonist to that mix, and that is going to take away all of those sensory cues or dampen them. And it just makes it a lot more difficult. And it makes it very difficult. So I think when I have an individual who has diabetes and also has a history of an eating disorder, in anorexia, it's a no-go. But they have a history of like binge eating disorder or bulimia nervosa, and they have diabetes. The conversation is, I'm not saying no, like this is not a hard stop, but we have to have a very careful conversation about what it is we're doing, why we're doing it, and what the risks are. The other thing that can happen is the rebound binging after stopping a GLP-1 receptor agonist can be very extreme. So it's not an absolute contraindication, but one thing is that the treatment goal is not weight loss. The treatment goal is to control the hemoglobin A1C and to reduce the emotional distress and the binge frequency. But when you're treating the eating disorder, the long-term gain is going to be from doing the psychotherapy. And so if you're just putting a Band-Aid on it by putting them on a GLP-1 receptor agonist, they're not going to fully recover from the eating disorder.
Yeah. So, Laura, you had mentioned that sort of weight loss not being the goal here, but just sort of more moving towards health. And we were talking before we started recording about even the use of the term obesity in the eating disorder realm and how that is almost verboten at this point now. I wonder if you could just sort of talk us through, I guess, the use of that word and sort of how it's viewed and sort of how we should be thinking about it, at least in this particular context.
So for a lot of individuals, so the other thing that I kind of do is weight-inclusive care. So when I'm not doing eating disorders, I'm practicing weight-inclusive primary care, even outside of like my patients who have eating disorders. And sort of one of the principles of weight-inclusive care is not use it, like we don't use the word obesity. So the word obesity has become pretty stigmatizing. And a lot of individuals who we would typically label as obese or would fall into like a BMI category of obese have experienced significant discrimination and weight stigma and sometimes even like healthcare related trauma. And that does tie into that word of obese. So the shift has been to not use that word. So, you know, like in my practice, I will refer to patients as larger bodied or larger.
So we talked about that. We have this patient with bulimia that came to us and it was on a GLP or is about to start a GLP-1 receptor agonist or requesting it for diabetes, which is uncontrolled. So we're having this delicate conversation about how, listen, first of all, we need to just be sure that our goal is health and our goal, if we were to use this medication, would not be weight loss. We're trying to get your A1C under control. And we would share our concerns about how we want you to be able to feel normal hunger and fullness signals. And that could be with when you're taking these medications, it kind of goes against that goal because we're trying to normalize eating patterns. So anything else for someone with bulimia that you recommend? Do all these people also, like we said for anorexia, a therapist or a dietitian, are these patients also all following that same kind of playbook?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And especially if they do have like an underlying diagnosis for which you want to use a GLP-1 receptor agonist, so they have comorbid diabetes or comorbid OSA, which, tirzepatide is FDA approved for OSA. I have a couple patients who have not responded to other treatments for OSA and were like really desperate for treatment that they can tolerate. So if there is an indication for which you're considering a GLP-1 receptor agonist, I would say they need even more careful medical monitoring for nutritional deficiencies and to make sure that they're eating. There's a risk that they can, we kind of mentioned this, but there's a risk that they can kind of develop atypical anorexia or anorexia type presentation. And there's a significant risk of malnutrition. So they definitely need to have careful monitoring for malnutrition and be following up with a dietitian and a therapist.
Okay. Yeah. So that sounds like a challenging case. Probably one we would refer to Laura, right, Paul?
Yes. I think that sounds appropriate.
Okay. All right, Isabel, let's get to our third case.
Sure. Our last one is George, who is a 50-year-old male with hypertension, coronary artery disease, severe OSA, and a BMI of 38, who comes for follow-up for your weight loss clinic with your PA, Madison. And after seeing George, the PA Madison informs you that she's concerned that George has might have an undiagnosed binge eating disorder and wants to collaborate with you on the next steps of care. So here we have a suspicion. Your PA here has her spidey senses because she's learned from you. And what kind of screening tools or history questions would you have your PA do, or would you start doing yourself in this case?
I think we kind of talked about this with the first cases, but again, I'm going to get that full sort of eating history and weight and diet history. But then ask those questions. So kind of the way that we define binging is eating a large amount of food, or what somebody would call like a large amount of food in a short period of time, and feeling loss of control over what you're eating, not associated with hunger. So you're not eating out of hunger. And again, that loss of control. So not wanting to be eating. And it's often associated with shame. The other things that can kind of clue into a binge eating disorder are like secret eating. So eating in secret and hiding the food, sort of like hoarding food. Night eating. Night eating syndrome is something different, but there can be an overlap. So like getting up in the middle of the night and eating.
Is that a sleep behavior, or is that they're just getting up in the middle of the night when no one's awake so they can eat in secret?
I would ask about all of those different behaviors. And you can have loss of so eating disorders and disordered eating. We haven't really talked about disordered eating, but eating disorders and disordered eating kind of exist on a spectrum of severity. So you can have disordered eating behaviors that don't really rise to the severity of an eating disorder, but can still cause significant distress to the individual. And so loss of control eating is sort of like the disordered eating version of binge eating. So they are kind of out of control eating and they don't want to be eating. And it's for a reason other than hunger, often like an emotional distress. And it's sort of a variation of degrees. I still treat it the same way.
So Laura, the difference between disordered eating and eating disorder, it sounds to me like you said they're on a spectrum. So disordered eating is like somebody has maybe some restrictive or maybe some binging type behavior or loss of control, but it's not rising to the level where you would make like a DSM-5 diagnosis of a specific eating disorder. Is that
correct?
That's correct.
Yes.
Okay. Because mm-hmm. I imagine that that's got to be insanely common compared to like someone that has like a full-on anorexia or bulimia or binge eating disorder, that there's lots of people that feel loss of control or that are like more restrictive than maybe you would consider is outside of the norm, and it's causing them some distress.
The way I conceptualize disordered eating and eating disorders is how much like functional impairment there is and if there are medical complications. Everybody that I know who tries to like diet ends up kind of cranky when they're not eating. So you can still have a little bit of like mood dysregulation, sleep dysregulation when you're having disordered eating. But when you start having like significant impacts in sort of like your social functioning, your occupational functioning, your health, your mental health, then you're starting to cross the boundary into an eating disorder.
I remember when we talked to Dr. Roz Kaplan years ago, Matt, about eating disorders. I think her initial screening question was, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong since you have that photographic memory, was, do you have a complicated relationship with food? And I just thought that was such an interesting sort of way to sort of start the conversation, because I feel like most people that you ask would probably say yes to that. And I feel like that's just not too far away from what you're talking about with the disordered eating, kind of the cultural pervasiveness of it. Back to our case, we have this patient for whom we're concerned about an eating disorder, perhaps a binge eating disorder specifically. So in this particular instance, so going back to the case and the role of a GLP-1 agonist in someone who has binge eating disorder, is there evidence that it may be helpful? Or is there a lot of, should I be as anxious as I would be for somebody who has this history of bulimia? So I guess what is the thinking around the GLP-1s in folks who have binge eating disorder?
I think very similar to the bulimia patient that we just discussed. So again, the indications for the GLP-1 receptor agonists are, you know, diabetes, weight loss, and for tirzepatide, they have the additional indication for OSA. So the risk that you're concerned about is worsening their symptomatology. And for individuals with any underlying eating disorder, I'd be worried that we're going to have them transition from either bulimia or binge eating into restriction, and that you're going to end up with a restrictive eating disorder instead of a bulimia or a binge eating disorder. So that's one concern that I would have. And then the same concern that we had when we talked about the previous case of the bulimia nervosa, that for any reason, if they had to stop the GLP-1 receptor agonist, that rebound binging can be very, very severe. So
is that specifically been described in people with eating disorders? Or because I know we've all seen like the studies of people who stop them, who have lost weight successfully, then stop them, they sort of regain weight. But is it specifically the binging is worse in people with eating disorders?
So I'm talking about a phenomenon separate from weight gain. Mm-hmm. In individuals who have eating disorders, they talk about food noise. What my patients have described to me is the return of this intense food noise with intense impulses and intense urges to binge that just will not go away. And so they have this rebound of the bulimia behaviors and the binge eating behaviors. Mm. One of the reasons that the GLP-1 receptor agonists are being looked at in eating disorders like bulimia nervosa and binge eating disorder is because they quiet, anecdotally, they quiet the food noise, and they take away these urges and the impulses by quieting the food noise. And the research suggests that that might be because of like how they work, like some of the pathophysiology of like where they're working, and they have some effect in like some of these reward pathways in the brain and the central nervous system. But there just haven't been any studies. So we're kind of like, there haven't been any like studies in humans with eating disorders to really see like how these would work and like what would happen. So we're functioning in a data void realm.
Do you expect that there are going to be trials, or are there things that are ongoing to try to answer this question?
I don't know of any trials that are going on right now, but there probably are.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that there will be. The mechanism of action of the medications is very intriguing because they do look like they act on these reward pathways. I mean, we know that the GLP-1 receptor agonist, and tirzepatide is a little bit different because it's a GIP agonist and a GLP-1 receptor agonist. So it's a dual agonist medication. But the mechanism of action is very interesting because it's not just acting on these like hormones of satiety. There also seems to be some activity on these like central nervous system pathways that are associated with sort of like reward, that kind of also overlap with some of like some of the things you see in like substance use disorder.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like very interesting stuff from like a pharmacologic standpoint. But I think we just have to be really cautious in like using these in patients before we really know what we're doing.
Mm. And there was several papers that we had shared around beforehand. One of them had a figure in there that was just showing it has a figure saying like it acts in there's GLP-1 receptors located in the arcuate nucleus of the hypothalamus, and it will stimulate the POMC/CART system, and it'll inhibit the neuropeptide Y and AGRP system. And one of those increases satiety and the other one reduces hunger, energy intake. And so it you know, theoretically there's some actual pathways that have been mapped out as how this works. And so we can link to that paper in there.
I think the interesting aspect in terms of like pharmacology and treatment of eating disorders is in impulse control. Emotional regulation and impulse control. From my standpoint, I'm less interested in hunger and satiety because it's not about suppressing hunger and satiety. You want individuals to be able to experience hunger and satiety. So I actually think that that's a downside to these medications. Mm-hmm. But they do seem to potentially have some ability to help with impulse control and like mood regulation in these reward pathways. And that kind of, we see that also in lisdexamfetamine, which is approved for binge eating disorder.
Mm-hmm.
It's also used to treat ADHD, and that medication, and also topiramate, which is an epileptic anti-seizure medication, like they seem to work for like, topiramate is off-label. So it's not FDA approved. Fluoxetine is FDA approved for bulimia nervosa. But those medications seem to work because of their effect on like impulse control and mood regulation. So I don't think it's about suppressing hunger and satiety.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not like an expert on this, but like from my clinical judgment, my anecdotal experience, I think it's more about the helping individuals with impulse control and emotional regulation. So back to the case, like I would be really concerned about suppressing this person's ability to feel hunger and fullness. Because I think that is potentially going to interfere with their long-term binge eating recovery.
Yeah. So it sounds like there are the FDA approved meds. You said lisdexamfetamine, and you said topiramate is off label, and fluoxetine for bulimia nervosa. Mm-hmm. So are these things you're using in your practice on the
yep.
regular?
Yeah, I often use a lot of fluoxetine for all of the different. Fluoxetine is great. You can use it for so many things. So I use a lot of fluoxetine for all of the eating disorders. It's FDA approved for bulimia nervosa, but I also use, I mean, like there's often comorbid anxiety and depression, trauma, OCD. There's a strong overlap with OCD, strong mm-hmm. overlap with ADHD. So I use a lot of fluoxetine. I don't use as much lisdexamfetamine because of the side effects. Because it's a stimulant, and also because of the prescribing restrictions. Mm-hmm. But it is effective for binge eating disorder. You have to be careful, again, because it is an appetite suppressant. So you do have to use some caution with that. Topiramate is a little, I would say topiramate is a little controversial among some eating disorder specialists, but I do use it in my practice. I find that it is effective for a little bit of, like, it tends to have a little bit of anxiolytic effect and mood stabilization, and helps individuals a little bit with that impulse control in low doses. So, but again, side effects are always problematic.
So I think we've probably run out of time here, and we should get to our take-home points. I think we could keep going on with this, because this is, this seems like a deep well to keep going on with discussion. But how about we get your take-home points, if there was just two or three that you wanted our listeners to really remember?
So when we're talking about GLP-1 receptor agonists in any individual in whom you're concerned about an eating disorder, I would say proceed with caution, and you're doing individualized decision making. For an individual who has a history of an eating disorder, or for whom you're concerned there may be an active eating disorder or disordered eating, I would not make weight loss one of the treatment goals. I would sort of take that out of the equation and try to focus more on, like, the behavioral regulation and improvement in sort of, like, their psychological symptoms and their eating behaviors. The sort of fundamental groundwork, sort of first line therapy, is psychotherapy and nutritional rehabilitation. So you want to make sure you're referring your patients to an eating disorder experienced dietitian, registered dietitian, and therapist or counselor. And there just needs to be a lot more research in this area. There are going to be more and more of these medications. There are a lot of medications that are sort of in the research pipeline right now that work on other receptors and related pathways. So we need more research.
Paul, there's just like a gigantic natural experiment. These medications can't fly off the shelves fast enough. And it's just a giant natural experiment that's occurring, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think I'd read in an older paper, like 2% of the population have been prescribed a GLP-1 agonist within a year's time. So, like, I feel like there's plenty of chart excavation and retrospective studies that can at least be done as a start. But yeah, there's lots of stuff to explore still.
Right. All right. Well, thank you, Laura, so much for all your time and teaching. And we will head to our outro.
This has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole.
Yummy, yummy.
Still hungry for more? Join our Patreon and get all of our episodes ad-free, plus twice monthly bonus episodes at patreon.com/curbsiders. You can find our show notes at thecurbsiders.com and sign up for our mailing list to get our weekly show notes in your inbox. This includes our Curbsiders Digest, recapping the latest practice-changing articles, guidelines, and news in internal medicine.
And we're committed to high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and we want your feedback, so email us at askcurbsiders@gmail.com. A reminder that this and most episodes are available for all health professionals through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. Special thanks to our writer and producer for this episode, PA Isabel Valdez, and to our whole Curbsiders team. A special thanks to our listener, PA Madison Donnelly, who reached out and requested this interesting and important topic. So thank you, Madison. Our technical production is done by the team at PodPace. Elizabeth Proto does our social media. Jen Watto runs our Patreon. Krista Chumenchu moderates our Discord. Stuart Brigham composed our theme music. And with all that, until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Frank Watto.
I'm your PA, Isabel Valdez.
And as always, our main Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Thank you and goodbye.